Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about police misconduct, big votes in the Senate that helped save Big Pharma, and the performance, if you will, of the Democrats and others in the confirmation hearings for Trump's cabinet nominees. But before we can move on, as we reported briefly yesterday, in the late afternoon, the city of Baltimore and the Department of Justice agreed to a court-enforceable consent decree to address the widespread misconduct and unconditional behavior revealed in the Justice Department investigation of the Baltimore Police Department, launched as a response to unrest surrounding the murder of Freddie Gray. It's also worth noting that this agreement has been signed over the objections of the police union there in Baltimore. The 227-page document is quite comprehensive and allegedly will put in place a wide range of new practices. The Baltimore Sun lists some of the main points of the report, and they are, and I'm just going to read through a list of them here, that officers introduce themselves by name and rank and refrain from forcing people not suspected of crimes to cooperate, that officers fill out forms for each stop recording the location and race and ethnicity and age of the person stopped, that a task force be appointed to study and make recommendations to improve the civilian review board, which considers complaints against officers, that officers receive 8 hours of training each year on how to better engage the public, work with neighborhood and community groups, and interact with young people, members of the LGBT community, the homeless, and the mentally ill. Notification of a supervisor before an officer makes an arrest on minor charges, including obstructing, hindering, or resisting an officer, disorderly conduct, failure to obey an officer, gambling, making a false statement, or trespassing. Efforts to better coordinate with Baltimore City Public School Police. Improved training for sexual assault detectives and increased oversight of their investigations. That officers who carry a firearm also carry one less lethal weapon. That all vans and police cruisers have functioning seatbelts, and that all detainees be secured with them while being transported. Easier methods for filing complaints, including a 24-hour hotline. Significant upgrades to the department's technology. Also, there are some other some of those changes they say that they have already started to move on, but also there's some other prohibitions that include and this is things that they prohibit now: using chokeholds or neck holds unless deadly force is authorized and no other alternative exists, basing an investigatory stop or detention, quote, only on an individual's response to the presence of police officers, such as an individual's attempt to avoid conduct with an officer, end quote, stopping and detaining people who are in the company of others suspected of a crime without being able to make a case that person has committed a crime or is about to, frisking a person without making the case that the person is dangerous, or frisking or searching LGBT people for the purpose of assigning a gender based on the person's anatomy. As the Sun notes also, however, the new administration, presidential administration now, Donald Trump's administration, could undermine a lot of this by, in the words of the Sun, quote, advocating for a monitor who opposed reforms, declining to seek the decree's enforcement, or expressing a starkly different philosophy of criminal justice in court. So it remains to be seen whether or not this agreement will mean much or even be enforced. It almost certainly will be one of the last consent decrees we see for a little bit now. And either way, it's clear that the struggle that has raged in the streets for 2 years around policing and mass incarceration has not been in vain. Changes are happening. And even if they are incomplete, institutions of power were at the very least moved to try to mollify the anger of the people. And that's a start. It isn't so much that they didn't do anything as much as what they did do seemed almost like they were mailing it in. Well, I'm talking about the Democrats' questioning of Donald Trump's cabinet officials this week. It all started with Jeff Sessions. Sessions, many people felt, was someone they would ask really tough questions of, in particular because he had actually already been rejected as a federal judge in 1986 for being too racist. At that time, Senator Ted Kennedy said that Sessions was, quote, a throwback to a shameful era, which I know both black and white Americans thought was in our past. Ohio Senator Howard Metzenbaum said then, we have a nominee here with marginal qualifications who lacks judicial temperament as well as a commitment to fairness and equality. This time around, Senator Dianne Feinstein, when she was introducing the Democrats' indictment of Sessions, actually semi-apologized to him before starting in on his record, saying that given their 20-year history, it was, quote, very difficult for her to criticize him. Sessions was asked if he agreed grabbing a woman's genitals was sexual assault. He said, I mean, I don't know what else you would say while under oath, yes. But no one asked a follow-up question of him of why then, 3 months ago, he responded to the same question with, quote, I don't characterize that as sexual assault. I think that's a stretch. In a statement he released later to try to explain himself, he said he only answered that way because he was, quote unquote, confused. So that seems like that also might have been a relevant question to ask. Why someone who could be the nation's top law enforcement officer is confused about something that not one other person in the world found either confusing or hard to characterize. One big issue with Trump's nominee for Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, was the issue of civilian control of the military. The Secretary of Defense is supposed to be a civilian, and if they are formally a military person, they have to have been out of it for 7 years. Mattis did not meet those qualifications, and thus many felt he should not be eligible. However, all but three Democrats joined Republicans to grant the waiver, and Senator Tim Kaine, most recently a Democratic candidate for vice president, noted that he wasn't worried about it because Mattis once wrote a book about the subject. Democratic Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico let Rex Tillerson slide on answering yes or no on whether or not climate change was caused by humans. And when Senator Bob Corker, a Republican, tried to question Tillerson further on the matter, Udall actually broke into the conversation to save Tillerson from having to give a real answer. Elaine Chao essentially just had a hangout session in her hearing about her nomination to head the Department of Transportation. No one sought to delve that closely into her past record as George W. Bush's Secretary of Labor, which is pretty relevant because a GAO study from 2008 found that under her tenure that there were 70,000 wage and hour cases that the department handled improperly, resulting in people not getting paid correctly for the work that they had actually done, which seems pretty relevant given that that's one of the Department of Labor's main responsibilities, which speaks at the very least to management skills, if not corporate capture. They also did not question her for two controversial mine collapses under her tenure where she came under fire or for allegations she once violated the Hatch Act. Ben Carson also had a fun time. How do I know? He said at the end he had a fun time. Senators were laughing and joking with Carson and occasionally asking a question. Literally, Carson never even said the words Section 8 during the whole thing, which clearly shows he was not questioned very hard at all. Basically, he said almost nothing about housing and urban development, despite the fact that he was nominated to be the secretary of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I mean, it was so ridiculous that Carson even got away with sneaking in a line that appeared to reflect him saying that he was against the minimum wage as a concept. No one really said much. How that is at the top line of the entire testimony, who knows? A top Democratic aide told the Huffington Post they weren't really worried because as long as Trump was just insulting them and they were talking about, quote unquote, things that matter to people, the contrast would be clear. Tim Kaine said he thought it was okay because people wanted him to talk about, quote unquote, substance. Well, that's all well and good, but as we just showed, they didn't really talk about the things that matter to people, nor was their questioning very substantive. So much for that Democratic Party-led resistance. As the brewing conflict about the future of health care starts to shape up in America, a Senate vote yesterday afternoon showed us which senators were so in the pocket of Big Pharma they couldn't even symbolically vote to lower prescription drug prices. Senator Bernie Sanders, that is, introduced an amendment that would have allowed Americans to import their prescription drugs from Canada, where they are considerably cheaper, in particular because that country uses its single-payer health care system to bargain down the cost of drugs through bulk pricing and by statutory and regulatory bodies aimed at preventing price gouging. Now, if this sounds eminently reasonable, that's because it is. In 2000 and 2007, drug importation bills actually passed Congress but never were fully implemented. And yesterday, all but 13 Democrats voted in favor of the amendment, as well as 13 Republicans voted in favor of it. One of the 13 Democrats who voted against the amendment and for Big Pharma was Cory Booker, one of the Democrats' rising stars and someone who has been trying to, as of late, strike a progressive political profile. He, and for the first time in history, testified against Jeff Sessions. First time a senator has testified against a senator. So what happened? Why did Booker and the 12 other Democrats defect? Why didn't the bills from 2000 or 2007 become active law? Well, basically because the big pharmaceutical companies are lying. And as we reported to you yesterday, these companies are actually well known for lying. They're known mostly for lying about profits and price gouging, but this is really just an extension of that. Big Pharma has a talking point out that says that importation of drugs from Canada would be quote unquote dangerous because foreign regulators won't ensure quality safety standards. Now, beyond the fact that we're talking about Canada, this is the height of absurdity given that most of these drugs are actually manufactured in the United States. So in the words of the Republican Tim Pawlenty, where are the dead Canadians? Show me the dead Canadians. The bills in previous years that had passed had a clause that required the FDA to certify the imported drugs were safe, and the Clinton and Bush administrations refused to do that at the pleas of Big Pharma, thus it withered on the vine. Further, during the writing of the Affordable Care Act, Democrats killed an importation provision because they thought including it would cause Big Pharma to lobby against the bill and kill it. As we can see from yesterday, they are still spending the big bucks for results. Cory Booker has received $267,000 from pharmaceutical companies over the past 6 years, more than any other Democratic senator. And other Democrats like Bob Casey, Patty Murray, and Michael Bennett all also cashed six-figure checks from the pharmaceutical industry and all also voted against the amendment. 72% of Americans support drug importation, yet big money from drug companies is making sure they don't get their wish. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And we are very happy to continue this conversation on this Friday. We have Bob Schlehuber here with us in the studio. He is a news analyst here at Radio Sputnik. Bob, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I want to start here with this issue of Cory Booker and the money or whatever it is that he's taken from pharmaceuticals and the vote that he's putting in there. I mean, it's just very interesting to me that, you know, it's front page of all the news. The front page of all the news that's taking place about Cory Booker is, well, he testified against Jeff Sessions, and no one really talking about, other than progressive activists on the internet, the fact that he then voted in favor of Big Pharma and what was a symbolic vote. How progressive is he?
Yeah, I think this speaks a lot to what we talked about last Friday when it came to Senator Kamala Harris from California not prosecuting One West, the mortgage company, and going after it. I think more and more Democrats, especially in the kind of the centrist liberal parts of the Democratic Party, need to realize and either come to terms with or kind of push back that a lot of their favorite sons and daughters of the party are taking big money from big corporations. That's just the name of the game when it comes to politics. We saw Barack Obama was the first person ever to not take publicly financed presidential campaign because he was in bed with Wall Street with big corporations. So as a Democrat, these Democrats then need to say, hey, this is just how it is. This is how politics in America plays. As long as we have Citizens United and you need these huge amounts of money to get elected, at times, we're going to have our Cory Bookers have to take money from pharmaceutical companies. Well, when you do play that game of big money politics, and unfortunately with the laws established how they are, you have to play that. That means then you're going to get your progressive, so-called progressive Democrats voting in favor with these big companies and big pharmaceuticals. I kind of love the irony that I've reached out to a lot of liberal Democrats over the last few years and say, hey, I'd love to talk more. And I had several people that I got nothing out of. And then yesterday I posted this story about Cory Booker taking this money, and people all of a sudden then were jumping on my, then they wanted to engage, you know, dead quiet when you just kind of reach out to them and say, we want to talk. The second you challenge their beliefs that they're heroes of the party, their future of the party, this Cory Booker, who some people have said is their number one running mate or presidential candidate in 2020, is taking big money from people, all of a sudden, then they're going to lash out, then they're going to protect the guy. It's crazy to me that they're not seeing this continued pattern. And this is the same thing that Hillary Clinton got beat up on, right? Because she couldn't say, hey, I'm a progressive, I'm a champion of the people, when she's getting million-dollar checks from these big banks to go and give speeches? Is if Cory Booker is not also going to those galas for these big pharmaceutical companies and doing favors for them as well. So what is he going to say to people when they say, hey, are you with us? Are you going to fight for us? Are you going to keep us healthy? And people that are in poverty that you represent and you say you represent need these cheaper drugs, but then you're protecting the big pharmaceuticals to keep their prices at exorbitant rates, which you talked about on the show, that they have one of the highest profit margins out of any business in America. When it comes down to people's health, you're taking hundreds of thousands of dollars for them from your campaigns. It's crazy to me that these stories and these conversations aren't being had on a daily basis.
No, I agree. And we're also joined here in our conversation over the next hour by Perry Redd, who is the executive director of Sincere 7, which is a workers' rights organization. And I think that's very relevant, Perry, because obviously the issue of the cost of prescription drugs is a huge issue for working class people in the United States of all colors, but certainly in the black community, those many things heavily affected. And you look at a guy like Cory Booker. On the one hand, he's testifying on Sessions. On the other hand, he's voting against big pharmaceuticals. It almost sort of seems like this Obama redux where people are using their blackness essentially to, in and of itself, gain progressive bona fides, but not doing anything else to really back that up in a significant way.
Thanks for allowing me to join the conversation, Eugene. It is a sad commentary for basically these Democratic whores, for lack of better words, to walk into these hearings and as if they are pristine and the pure alternative to these ultra conservatives, when they practice the same money grubbing, basically allowing themselves to be pimped. One thing I think the blackness is tarnished by, and hopefully they see this, that the last three to testify at the hearing yesterday against Jeff Sessions were the black testifiers, the ones in offering Congress, testimony, yeah. You know, before the Senate Confirmation Committee for Jeff Sessions. And, you know, this was, for me, it just said to me that, you know, once again, you know, you're at the back of the bus, you have to realize who you are in relationship with these people, and your any genuineness that you may have had is brought into question by you showing up here and acting like everybody else is so tarnished when you've tarnished yourself. You know, you and Bob just brought up the fact that Wall Street has paid these folks off, Big Pharma's paid these folks off, and they are acting like someone else is against the interests of the people when they have been against the interests of the people all along.
And just say it. Say, we need this money to get elected. That's just what politics is, as opposed to lying to people and then having a voting record. And people go, oh, this isn't true, but the FEC tells you who donates to you, and the Senate voting record shows how you vote. So people aren't dumb. They can see the records on government records that show it. It's not about fake news or about this media source or another. This stuff is congressional record in front of you, and yet they pretend it's not there.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point, and we are going to come back with that and much more here on By Any Means Necessary, here on Radio Sputnik from our studio in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're continuing our conversation, kind of wrapping up the week from this confirmation extravaganza and touching on some of the big things that have come up as well in the course of the week, although they've flown under the radar, including the Baltimore consent decree that I want to move to. But, you know, I also wanted to speak really quickly, too, to something that you raised that I thought was very relevant at the end there, Bob, of our last segment, which is, you know, the FEC does track donations. And what's funny about that is people always say, and this is actually the rule, that the legal knowledge behind Citizens United was, well, you got to have a smoking gun, right? Like, you got to have like a note, or it's a taped conversation of me saying, well, Perry, here's $50,000 for you to vote on this. But it's also worth noting, I always think, I mean, not only is that a ridiculous precedent, but in the very first case in the Supreme Court to regulate campaign finance, Buckley v. Vallejo, the whole point they made in there, and I think it's very relevant, is they said, who knows if most of this is corruption, but that the government has a interest in legislating this just because the appearance of corruption. So it doesn't really matter if you took the money and then didn't do it. Just the appearance that I took this money, then I voted, in and of itself is corrosive to the political atmosphere, which I think is so key. But anyway, let's move on. And we'll come back to more, of course, on the Democrats and confirmation extravaganza. But I want to touch a bit on this Baltimore city consent decree. We mentioned it off the top. If you're just tuning in, the city of Baltimore and the Justice Department reaching an agreement on a consent decree in the wake of the Baltimore Justice Department report, allegedly dealing with many of the things that were going to come. So, Perry, I'm sure you've seen a little bit of this as well. I mean, this is kind of became a big deal at the beginning part of this week when it leaked that the Obama administration was going to try to get this thing in under the wire because their assumption is the Trump administration wouldn't have pushed forward on it. I mean, are you seeing any significance in this consent decree, or just, you know, legacy protection at the end?
You know what, Eugene? Obama, with these last minute actions, I would like to think that he's doing it because it is the right thing to do. I'd like to think that he is doing it because it is more than expedient. But very simply, this is about legacy, making sure he's able to say he did something. Just like with the Cuba wet foot, dry foot policy, you wait till now to do it. And I'm of the mind that those in this country should be cognizant and aware that this is long overdue. And Obama could have done this after his first term when he won the second term. I just can't see how he is expecting to have any real credibility by waiting until now to do this. And the consent decree, this is what's problematic to me. These last-minute decrees or these consent decrees, because Chicago did the same thing, and it has not changed the way they do business. And that's what worries me most. You know, with Ferguson, it has changed some things in Ferguson, but that's kind of went quiet. It's went silent. And I wonder what the progress is really looking like. So to answer your question, Eugene, it's about legacy.
Yeah, well, and I think it's a very good point as well, Bob, because one of the issues that, you know, we've talked about consistently on this show, and we've certainly talked about it on this show when Perry's been on as well in the past, is this issue of the sort of police policing themselves. And I mean, like, I guess in like a perfect world, you know, and gumdrop land or whatever, we could all believe that, like, yes, they will reform themselves. But I mean, it really was just a few months ago that Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney there, said that the police went out of their way to sabotage her case in the Freddie Gray case. So if these are the same people who are willing to sabotage the case in the Freddie Gray case to make themselves look better, it doesn't seem that likely that they would do anything different in this, that they would try to sabotage this too.
Well, even the problems of if you did policing right is almost a fallacy. And talking to a police officer, not far from Chicago, and talking to a Chicago police officer over the holiday, he was talking about how so many police officers have begun just looking the other way. Crime arrests have been so down over the last 6 months in Chicago, not because there's probably not less crime, but because police officers haven't wanted to risk getting in trouble, which tells you, is there any way to do policing in their minds that doesn't get them in trouble, which is really crazy to me to think that there's not like a proper way for this to work. And there isn't. I think that's what we're ultimately learning, that how we have established our law and order structure in America, one that protects elite, protects white, protects capitalist, is not a model that works for everyone. And so can you reform something that is inherently broken, that inherently doesn't work for a large percentage of people? I don't think so. So you can have these consent decrees, but ultimately we're trying to fix something that's completely broken, when we've talked about and we continue to talk about alternative models to policing, some community building, community engagement, conflict resolution tactics that have shown like cure violence, that have shown like safe streets, have shown like cease fire, don't shoot the brothers here in Washington, D.C. But yeah, we don't fund those. So it's crazy to me that we spend how many millions of dollars investigating what's wrong with policing, spending millions of dollars trying to fix what's wrong with policing, spending millions of dollars of paying off the consequences of bad policing, but yet we don't spend that same money on programs that actually work. And at some point, we have to recognize that we've gone insane, that we simply are not going to solve the problem of policing by trying to reform the current police structure.
Well, and I think that's a good point, too, Perry, because it makes me think there's almost like a trap door in this consent decree, too, because you look at Baltimore, you look at Chicago, where also the Justice Department report on policing there came out today as well. Loretta Lynch announced this morning at a press conference. These are cities with, like, you know, quote-unquote spiking violence. And even for Chicago, everyone's saying Chicago is the worst of the worst, this is actually not the record of people who have been killed. It was worse there in the 90s, so it's a fake thing. But nevertheless, the perception is these are these crime-ridden cities. And I wonder if, say, crime doesn't go down, or quote-unquote crime doesn't go down over the next year, then the Trump administration now has this talking point, oh, we'll see, and this speaks to what Bob's saying, they've been tying their hands. And so then they'll come back and say, oh, we'll see, Black Lives Matter said come out and make all these changes, and in the cities that have tried to make the changes, people are just getting killed.
Mm. It's a setup for failure. And when you look at the points within the consent decree, some of them are so, elementary in nature. These are just practices, policies that if you don't follow them, I want to know why have we not demanded people be thrown in jail? And of course we have. But the defense of this law enforcement complex is sinful. Listen to this. One of their recommendations, because that's all they come out to in this consent decree, or they've consented to do it, is to transport detainees in a manner that keeps them safe. Mm. Why do you have to tell someone that?
Mm.
You know, to ensure that officers use appropriate de-escalation techniques and attempt to resolve incidents without force when possible. Why do you have to tell a human being that?
Right.
Much less a sworn peace officer. Or to ensure that officers investigate sexual assault thoroughly and without gender bias. Why do you have to tell someone that?
Right.
And if indeed you have to tell someone this, then you already have admitted within this consent decree that they're not training properly.
Mm.
Well, it's not the trainees who are the problem. It's the trainer, the ones in authority. And we place these people in authority and in high esteem and then... push to the public that you're not to question these people. You know, I've been of the mind for a long time that the only way to remedy a problematic institution is to tear it down. And I've been saying for the longest that burning the mother down is not necessarily the worst thing that could happen. You see in Baltimore and in Ferguson, the peaceful protests gained the people nothing. It wasn't until you threaten the commerce of a city, of a jurisdiction, that change actually comes. These kumbaya type of tactics, like these consent decree, is garbage.
And so many of the problems, too, it really boils down to what you're talking about, the code of blue and the code of silence, right? That these people feel like, even though they're public servants, even though that so many progressives and so many everyday people are on their side that advocate for better funding for public citizens, be it your garbage workers, your firefighters, your EMT, or your police officers. These are people that we uphold in our community that we said collectively, like, hey, let's pay for this, and we want to be there for you. But when you continue to stand in silence, when you see these acts, I mean, again, talking to police officers and the stuff they'll tell you that they see, they go, you know what, I saw it. I saw this person get handcuffed to a radiator. One police officer was telling me that they had this guy handcuffed to a radiator, and his lieutenant came in and started hitting the guy, and he had just started. And so they had an investigator come in the next week and go, hey, did you see anything? Well, his lieutenant at a new job just told your boss's boss's boss did something on your first week, and all of a sudden you're supposed to be emboldened enough to speak out. They're put in such ridiculous situations that there is no other alternative, and we're putting police in traumatic situations themselves.
Well, yeah, and I mean, as we were talking about yesterday, too, in terms of that Pew poll on the policing, the vast majority of police officers, I think it was 72%, said that they don't think the worst people on the police force are ever held accountable. So, like, I thought that was pretty
72%.
Crazy. And given how, like, what most police officers think is justified, you can only imagine the types of things these people they don't think are being held accountable must be doing.
And then we live in this weird world, too, where people, everyday people, are more for the police than I think a lot of police are for themselves, where they're saying, hey, we need to have somebody come in here and regulate this. We need somebody to keep these officers in check. These people are often going beyond what they're supposed to. And a lot of people, in the Laquan McDonald people case, for example, the man that was shot in Chicago where there was a murder charge brought against the police officer, you had so many everyday citizens saying, well, hey, man, he slashed the tires of a car. He was doing drugs, running from police. Mm-hmm. And you talk to police officers that go, no, that police officer needs to be arrested because that makes us look bad. That puts us in danger because now all police are targeted because of these people doing these bad things. But yet everyday people are like, well, the police was justified in doing it, even though police officers are saying 72% of them are saying people are not held accountable. But when everyday people say, hey, police are there to protect me at all times, I'm not going to second guess calling the police. What are we supposed to expect when the police officers continue to do this?
Well, I think it's a good point, Perry. And I think it also speaks to the fact that, you know, the indictment of Hollywood, and we talk about this a lot in promoting a fiction on the police. I mean, if you were writing a Hollywood script and you took like the six or flat four consent decrees we've had in the past couple years, I think what Cleveland's had, whatever, all of them, and you took those and you made a cop show, it would look nothing like any of the cop shows that are, except like the occasional one that's all like The Shield. Honestly, The Shield on FX, like in the early part of the 2000s, that was the only like cop show I can really remember off the top of my head where like the cops were just like a crazy lawless gang running around doing whatever they want to do, which is, you know, often in and of itself, that show was obviously a little bit played up, but it's certainly closer to what we see in, say, the Cleveland Justice Department report or the Chicago Justice Department report or Ferguson or Baltimore than what I see on average, which is like the police are all good, hardworking people that even if they like kidnap you and beat you in like a secret facility, it's only because they're trying to save like a baby from being murdered. You know, I mean, it's just like it has nothing to do with reality.
Well, you know, the non-reality of this is scary to me, you know, and I cannot live my life in a vacuum. I can't live my life trying to stay out the way, quote unquote, because I hear that from a lot of young black men in particular. You know, how you doing, brother? Oh, man, I'm just trying to stay out the way. Well, you know what? You shouldn't have to stay out the way, okay? Because the majority of Americans don't live their lives this way. Those who voted for Donald Trump, when we're talking about white middle class, middle America, they don't live their lives to stay out of the way. And you shouldn't have to either. I guess, you know, Eugene, Bob, you know, the biggest struggle for me is that I have 14 grandchildren, and all of them are under 16 years old, and I am highly concerned. Majority of them are boys, and I'm highly concerned at what their lives have before them. So I have to actually ask myself the question every day, and every time I see another shooting by police, I have to ask myself, what is it? What is my true objective when it comes to opposing these policies or opposing a police shooting or even educating my grandchildren? What is the overall goal? Is it to save their lives? Is it to teach them how not to offend police? You know, because that whole concept pisses me off too.
Right.
I should not have to live my life with an extra hurdle. But here we are, 2017, and living like it's 1940.
I think it's a good point. I mean, you know, when Obama did the policing town hall, you know, I couldn't even watch it. And then I see people blowing it up on Twitter about how he's on there with some police chief talking about, here's where you got to put your wallet and your information and not get shot. And I was like, honestly, like Obama could have put in single payer health care and that would have just discredited him to me like right there. Like, are you kidding me right now? Like, first of all, I think clearly the videos and things we've seen that there is no way to do anything that guarantees you won't be killed by the police. Like that just doesn't even exist. But even the fact that like the president's town hall on policing is having like a walkthrough 1, 2, 3, like if you are black, do all these special things so that you don't randomly get killed, as if that's not like, and here's the president, a black person, and in acting as if, and I'm saying acting, I'm sorry. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're Clarence Thomas. No black person is that dumb to think that somehow this is true. So basically already you're putting on a show to make it seem as if it's reasonable, that there's some reasonable backing behind these police officers killing people. It's crazy to me.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the criticism, I feel like we often come off as anti-police in these criticisms, but this is not a healthy way for these police officers to live. The rates of domestic abuse, the rates of alcoholism amongst police officers. We need to be conscious as just fellow humans that care for other humans, that we're putting people in an unwinnable situation. We're putting them into cultures that lead to violence. lead to power structures that allow people to get away with these types of misconduct. This isn't about anti-police or being against police. This is about how do we create better conditions for humans to thrive and to live in dignity. And yet people are forced to live in undignified ways. And I'm sitting here as a white man criticizing this, and I think it's absolutely spot on what you're saying, Eugene. It was about how black people should act when they're with police. No, it should be how people should act, and it shouldn't have one rules for black people and one rules for white people. And the fact that the president and police officers and officials are spending an exorbitant amount of attention in black communities saying, here's how you should interact with police, and not that same amount of attention in white communities, should say enough about the problems that we're seeing within our policing in America.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good point, Bob. And it raises one other issue that I want to raise with you, Perry, too, just in terms of Obama's legacy that's relevant to that, which is the foreign policy piece. I mean, it's crazy to me. You can't just be like, yeah, I did the Affordable Care Act, so like, who cares if I launch this massive drone campaign that's killed probably thousands of innocent civilians, including kids? I mean, it really is just unbelievable sort of the way American exceptionalism will erode the value of human life when people make these sort of conversations about what's so-and-so's legacy. About a minute and a half till our next break.
Well, you know, the saddest part, sadly enough, the saddest part about Obama's foreign policy legacy is that his foreign policy legacy was crippled by his attempts to please everyone. It was sullied by the fact that President Obama had to placate the conservatives, the war hawks, by saying that he was tough as a commander in chief. And by playing that game, he effectively destroyed his legacy. You know, the drone campaigns, even calling for Syrian President Assad, drawing the red line, a red line that was ignored by Israel and Russia and all of those other opposers. So he basically came off as totally emasculated only because he set himself up to fail.
It is true. I hear you. Well, we are going to take another break here and come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are continuing our week in review, if you will, here with Perry Redd and Bob Schlehuber, touching on confirmation hearings, consent decrees, and the like. So I want to switch back a little bit here to this whole issue of the hearings and everything happening with the hearings. And while I do want to talk about, you know, Mr. Carson's hearing, I do want to touch on one other issue, which I think is relevant to a lot of what we were talking about in relationship to Baltimore, policing, race, the Sessions hearing. Now, I mean, obviously, this is a guy who is rejected in 1986 for being a racist. He's back up here. And the thing that struck me, Perry, is Dianne Feinstein, who's the ranking Democrat, before she gets ready to sort of list the charge sheet that Democrats have against Sessions, things they don't like about him, she says, but she's known him for 20 years, and it makes it hard for her to criticize him. And then they had all these people who, before they'd say anything, say, oh, I've known him. He's a good guy. He's not a racist. He's this. He's that. And it's just crazy to me that this idea that just because some senator says he's like a decent guy, that can totally override all of the evidence regarding his actual beliefs on race.
I equate that with you're a good American. Mm. You know, it's a scary thing when your record, your merits don't speak for themselves. And we've been conditioned in this country to make sure that your actions outweigh your words. And with Jeff Sessions, his actions obviously mean nothing to us. So all the, you know, and someone said to me years ago that everything you needed to learn about how you interact with other people, you learned in kindergarten. So here we are back in kindergarten, and we don't get it. Okay, Jeff Sessions, he did these things. He tried to prosecute someone who was registering people to vote. And if your record doesn't speak for itself, then you being a good guy, that's sort of, it's like Trump, who says, well, he said nice things about me, so I say nice things about him.
Right. Which, by the way, Steve Harvey said today, just before we started the show, Steve Harvey coming out of Trump Tower, saying they had a very productive meeting.
Steve Harvey?
Yep. Don't ask me why. Don't ask me what for. All I know is he was up there, he met with Trump, and he said it went well.
Oh, every day I get sadder and sadder. Oh, my God. Steve Harvey, that's like, you know, what's that? Kanye West met with Don King. I'm like, you know what? I quit. Yeah. You know, I just want to throw my hands up and say, you know, these 4 years, I'm just going to erase them from my life, and I'm going to start over in 4 years. I'm going to pick up where I left off. You know, and it would be good if we could Rip Van Winkle this, because I'm just curious what it's going to look like in 2 years. Now, what my prediction is, and I was on another show just last night, Mark Thompson, I'm serious, but either Trump will get indicted, because every day there's a new episode with him, or he's going to get his coconut split. I mean, it's amazing that this man, he'll lambast the intelligence community, but he knows that they can watch him and catch him doing anything, and they can kill him at any time.
Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone.
I thought you knew.
No, great point there. And I'm curious, Bob, your thoughts on the general. I mean, Sessions, but just the bonhomie. I mean, you've got, you know, the Sessions thing where it's like, well, I mean, I know that you praised the Ku Klux Klan, but, you know, you're such a fun guy. Or the Elaine Chao one where, I mean, as I said in the beginning, it was like a hangout session. You got people just hanging out, having a good time. Mitch McConnell making jokes and the whole nine. Ben Carson, they're laughing, they're joking, they're thanking him for coming around. I mean, I would think even if I liked you, and even if we'd had a good meeting the day before, if allegedly my job as it concerns this is advising consent, that I gotta go kind of grill you, and that if we really have a good relationship, you would even know that, so it wouldn't be an issue. But it seems like they're all just backslapping.
You don't have to grill somebody. You can just ask them critical questions that allows you to understand their policy that they're going to put into place when in that position. And we obviously didn't get that. I mean, the Ben Carson hearing, not even referencing Section 8 vouchers here in Washington, D.C. We have 70,000 people that are on the backlog of Section 8 housing or trying to get the voucher to help them subsidize their housing. Would Ben Carson ideally be asked about what he would do for Section 8 policy when 70,000 people within his own backyard here in Washington, D.C. need these vouchers, are unable to reach these vouchers? It's an issue that we as Americans say we value, having housing for all. Would you not talk about this? And it really kind of speaks to this whole idea that there's separate Republican and Democratic establishments when there is one establishment. And it also speaks to the fallacy of this whole, like, we need to reach across the aisle, as if taking two policies or two policy platforms that aren't working, that if somehow you compromise between the two or merge the two, that it's somehow going to equal it. Two wrongs don't equal a right. I'm pretty sure the old phrase goes. And that's the kind of the mindset they have. And so why are you going to upset things when we want to work with this person, or they're our person, like our next cabinet member, and it's all about unity? And it comes at the expense of the 50 million people in this country that aren't able to get enough food on a daily basis. It comes at the expense of the 40% of Americans that are living paycheck to paycheck. These Congress members and senators and cabinet officials are not living paycheck to paycheck. They live in a comfortable situation. The programs and safety nets that they're there to administer aren't for them. They don't have the same realization, as much as Ben Carson says he grew up in public housing and that he himself understands what it's like to pull himself up. No, that's not his. That's not the actual story that he lives by. And it's such a small, narrow framed story. And it was also rich when Carson was saying, hey, I'm going to go on a listening tour and go hear people. It's like, you just ran for president. What have you been doing? Did you not hear anything that would then get you to say, hey, as HUD secretary, I'm going to bring up some of these critical issues myself, because I just was listening to people. And it shows, again, the narrowness and exclusivity that his presidential campaign was in and of itself.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's also just crazy logic. I mean, it's the I grew up in public. It's like saying I drove a car and thus should be Secretary of Transportation. I mean, like, it's just like there's so many more, so much more to it. It's crazy. But yeah, I mean, Perry Redd, I don't know what your thoughts were there on Dr. Carson. I don't even really know who to be more upset with, him or the people asking the questions. Cause like, you almost can't really blame Ben Carson for never mentioning the word Section 8 or talking about funding public housing. Cause I mean, they were barely asking him the questions, but nevertheless, some of the stuff he was saying, I'm just thinking like, who is this?
They being those on the committee who were questioning him, both Democrat and Republican, helping to facilitate the fraud. I mean, this is absolutely insane that a neurosurgeon would be chosen as the Secretary of HUD.
But he can do brain surgery, Perry, so therefore he can do all things difficult, according to one of the senators that was asking him. He goes, running HUD's not brain surgery. And since you can do brain surgery, you clearly can run HUD. That was a U.S. senator saying that somehow it equates that he can do something really difficult. It means he can do all things difficult.
Oh, my God.
1.2 million people that live in HUD housing now are relying on a brain surgeon to be able to protect them and continue their way of life.
And because you lived in public housing, would qualify you to run an agency is beyond me. I guess the joke is on us because all of these nominations have been absolutely comical, but somebody's serious about this. And, you know, I think the worst part for me, and Bobby, if you look at it like this, that these people have our lives. They have real people's lives in their hands.
Right.
And this is the scariest part about the people that Donald Trump has nominated for these positions, including the education nominee, DeVos, right?
Mm-hmm. That's DeVos, yeah.
This is scary that someone who has made a career out of privatizing education, as opposed to educating those who need to be educated, will be the one who has basically the one with the red phone when it comes to our education, the education of the youth in this country. It is problematic for me to think that a Ben Carson could be taken seriously, but he will be confirmed.
And it was also really alarming in the conversation yesterday when it came to talking about what to do with people on with Native Americans on reservations, which is also facing a crisis of housing. And Ben Carson's answer was, yeah, it's crazy. The amount of red tape, I had to go to the Interior Secretary, I had to go to the Department of Justice, I had to go through Housing Authority to be able to build on reservations. It's so onerous to have to do it, and I would get rid of some of those things. But we just saw Standing Rock and what happened there in South Dakota when private companies or U.S. government with the Army Corps tries to build on these native lands. They completely brutalize people. They don't respect any of their treaties. They don't do anything that is what I'm in line with or what everyday people are in line with, or at least the activists and organizers that responded out there. And at the same time, he also said, you know what, poverty is a major issue on these reservations as well as drug usage. We got to stop the drug trafficking to the reservations. And it just clearly shows that Ben Carson has no concept of why people in poverty turn to drugs, why people across the United States have started to use more opiates than ever before. And it continues in line. I mean, in so many ways, it's unchanged from the traditional government way of operating, where they always think people are criminals and they're bad and they're nefarious and there's no reason that they would ever use drugs outside of them just being bad people and wanting to exploit illicit markets. And without that kind of holistic understanding, nothing's ever going to get solved. And it's more evident with these hearings that everybody's going to work in their own silos and their own elitist kind of perspectives looking at the citizenry in the country.
One more thing too, Eugene, which amazed me about that hearing. Ben Carson got away with diverting the conversation. The hearing, he said, based on the history of failed socialist experiments in this country, entrusting the government to get it right can prove downright dangerous. Now, you got to remember, this country, at least what conservatives have taught me, what they told me, was the greatest country on earth.
Right.
This country, you know, right now, passing away is the greatest generation that this country's ever had. Talking about the World War II folks, the baby boomers and the like. Well, these folks went through public education before it was privatized.
Right.
And so if indeed that's the case today, you're misinforming us, but you're telling us that this was a socialist experiment that failed.
Right.
But your grandfathers and your fathers, they were failures now?
I mean, it's a good point. I mean, it just shows like what a throwback the current Republican Party. And for people to say, like, the Trump Republicans, that's ridiculous. It's all of them. I mean, it's because that's what they said in McCarthyism. They said anyone who supports integration is a communist. Mm-hmm. And that anyone who wouldn't be, you know, anyone for civil rights must be against America. And I mean, you look, they want to get rid of the income tax, the progressive reforms. I mean, they really want to take America back to the Gilded Age. No regulations, no minimum wage, no civil rights. I mean, just like, you know, no woman's right to choose. And if they could do it, they'd take away more people. I mean, and they are taking people's right to vote away. But in a way that's not, you know, technically taking people's right to vote away, but like actually doing it without a doubt. I mean, it really is such an unbelievable regression in the vision. So crazy. I mean, Bob, one thing I saw, Representative Bob Thorpe, no relation, a conservative lawmaker in the Arizona House.
Do you have any relation because they have the same first name?
I was joking, Bob. Joking. Now that you tried to call me on it, I may try to tie you to this gentleman. Bob Thorpe. In the Arizona House, very conservative guy, has put in a bill. Now, he put in this bill today, I believe. Martin Luther King Day is on Monday. This bill, House Bill 2120 in Arizona, would ban virtually every college event, activity, or course which discusses social justice, skin privilege, or racial equality. Like two days.
Hey, how do we just skip the next 4 years? I mean, I'm coming back to what you have. I'm on board with you. I just want to skip over it all.
Is there an over-the-counter opiate maybe that can put me to sleep? Unbelievable. I mean, the audaciousness, the absolute gall, the unmitigated gall, the insults upon the citizenry of this country. If you belong to a subset, which every human being in this country actually belongs to a subset. But you wouldn't tell it from some of the legislation that these folks are trying to pass. And it's sort of like Alec tells them, just throw it against the wall and see what sticks. Mm. You know, I mean, we've got more than half of the, two-thirds of the governors in this country are Republicans now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We have 27 right-to-work states. You know, you might as well, I want to say go to sleep, but, you know, at least for 2 years, because I just believe that the Republicans will self-destruct and they will get so greedy. You think about North Carolina, you know, what they've done to take their state back to Wilmington 1898. I really wish I could fall asleep on this. But, Bob, you know as well as I know, if we stand still, they would let the train run downhill on greased skis with their hair on fire, and they will burn it down. Mm. Mm. And their whole goal is to destroy government, and that's why they nominated Ben Carson. Mm. They, and when I say they, I'm talking about the ultra-conservatives, going all the way back to William Buckley. When he first got the conservatives together, he got the social conservatives together with the religious conservatives together with the fiscal conservatives, got them together and said, this is a long-term plan, but we will win. And now I'm feeling and I'm seeing and feeling the results. So real simply is this, that for the next 2 years at least, these folks going to run until the wheels fall off. Mm. The question is, what will we be doing for the next 2 years? Will we be organizing? Will we be putting together coalitions of folks, and will we be changing the way that we fund campaigns on the national scale?
And thinking of you mentioning William Buckley, it's really interesting. I think so much of the important need for people to counter these arguments is, one, to understand where they're coming from. And for William Buckley, he'll often say, you know what, it's not, we have nothing against black people, and black people should be lucky because it's better here in America than anywhere else in the world. So, you know what, it might be bad, but hey, at least it's not Nazi Germany. And it's like, one of these, like, wait, what? Like, what are we talking about? How is that the measurement for okay policy? And Buckley also really challenged people who said, then what? What's your alternative? And until lefties have an alternative progressive platform to run on, look at the movement for Black Lives, a great policy platform. The DNC in those leaks had said, hey, we don't support these concretely. So if the Democratic Party doesn't support the one alternative comprehensive policy platform and their own policy platform has come up short and so many people have already rejected it, what's the alternative? And you're going to get steamrolled if you don't have something to replace it with or be able to offer as an alternative.
I don't know. Look at the Republicans. Well, they're about to repeal Obamacare, right?
Right.
They have nothing to replace it with.
Well, you know, since MLK, I'd forgotten this, but I wanted to say it earlier. You know, Cory Booker, the day before, after he had voted against the pharmaceutical thing, he put out a tweet related to his testimony in the Sessions thing and was saying basically how, you know, he was great. He is an MLK quote. And I'm just thinking, forget students. If this dude who's been the mayor of like a medium-sized city, who's been a senator for several years, who is a Rhodes Scholar, can't understand that he is so far out of step with King's vision and is using him opportunistically, I don't know what to say, which means that he knows what he's doing and is doing it on purpose.
And somebody asked me today if what I would tell other white millennials about King's legacy as we come up with the holiday. And for me, it's to really dive deeper into King's legacy, right? I mean, everybody goes, oh, he had a dream, but it's because people were living in a nightmare. And a lot of people continue to live in a nightmare, and white people are fed kind of this nice, subtle, comfortable history of King, but we're not taught about the radical love of Malcolm X. We weren't taught that Nelson Mandela was a militant freedom fighter. We weren't taught about Assata Shakur. If anything, more and more white people really need to truly understand Black history and resistance movements if they're going to really comprehend what's taking place with white supremacists and from the right pushing these restrictive laws of freedom of speech on college campuses, which is the most offensive thing. If anywhere we're supposed to be able to have progressive, challenging, and not necessarily progressive, but at least debate in America, it is our college campuses, and that's completely being silenced.
Yeah, well, it's extremely ironic, too, especially because, you know, it's the right wing that started the year out in some ways talking about safe spaces. But the reality is that you know, they're now pushing for safe spaces from progressive ideas on campus. But nevertheless, I think that is going to be a decent place for us to leave it today for this week on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to all our guests. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and we will see you next time.
By Any Means Necessary.